And so when we set about to actually put the book together out of about the 200 actual essay submissions we got, we had to make some tough choices about what a geek is. Partly a geek is aviation gestures. we're really focused specifically on fields that involve people who are focused heavily on arcana or on extremely obscure technical topics, and also fields that are male-dominated. And so those are things like high-tech, many of the sciences, pretty much all of the sciences, comic book writing, comic book loving,
consensual.
Science fiction, not always, but we'll end up talking about that. Science fiction writing and adoring, and so areas like that where there are women and women's presence is increasing, but generally there's this sort of stereotype that the people who enjoy those kinds of geeky things are sort of pasty white boys who never get laid. And the fact is that they are getting laid, and maybe with some of the many women or other boys like them. So part of what we're trying to do is just demonstrate that yes, these women are out there. And in fact, do you want to ask that before I talking about sex?
We were really inspired by all the stories that people shared with us of their triumphs and their passion for geeky topics, and the love of arcana and obscure stuff, and it was just awesome, and math and Neville Longbottom and it was amazing. And at the same time, there was this sort of narrative arc that we saw in a lot of these pieces where people would sort of be like soaring in the geek stratosphere, and then somebody would be dragging them down. And there were a lot of people, for example, would be in undergrads and would be undergraduates and would be really, really successful in their field and like the top of their class, and then they get to grad school and suddenly it's like, oh wait, somebody is telling them they shouldn't be there, or somebody is like giving them a lot of bunk. And we saw that pattern over and over again, and we were like, we wanted to represent that side of the story as well. So I think the book actually is mostly really inspiring and uplifting, but it also kind of points to some of the problems that people are facing.
Yeah, there are some sad stories, but yes, Charlie likes to emphasize that there's happy stories too. So I think with all of that in mind, do you want to introduce our first reader, Devin Reisman?
Yeah, we're so stoked to have Devin in the book. I'm a huge fan of her writing since long before I met her. Devin Grayson is delighted to count herself among the dwindling number of former English majors to be gainfully employed in their chosen field. She is particularly grateful to DC Comics for letting her hide a burgeoning personality disorder behind the facade of work for the last 8 years, and actually tickled to append a few novels. Devin currently resides in Oakland, California, with 3 frogs, 4 computers, a feline muse, and her wonder dog, Cody. Please welcome Devin Grayson.
I've read the lineup for tonight's reading, and all I can say is gaming at my place after this. All right. I'm just going to jump in the middle. I can still remember standing with a tree branch lightsaber squinting in the sun outside of Zach Brogan's house in the summer of 77. Zach wanted to be Luke, and we were in his yard, so that was fine. That was a given. But Jacob and I had the entire rest of the cast left to argue over, and the results of that brief and amicable quarrel defined much of the rest of my life. We need Han and Leia, Zach decided. I'll be Han, I said, tossing aside the long branch I'd been holding. Jacob's jaw dropped. But that would mean I'm Leia. Right, Zach confirmed, because I found a shorter, more blaster-like stick a few feet away. Jacob's voice rose to a slightly panicked whine. But I don't want to be Leia. I spun toward Jacob, brandishing my new stick, and gleefully mimicked a Harrison Ford-like sneer. Well, I sure as hell ain't gonna do it, sweetheart. I remember my throat tightening as Jacob then turned to Zach, desperate to impute femininity to me. But she's the girl, he protested. Zach stood behind us, arms folded, and nodded thoughtfully before delivering his final verdict. I saw Liam look me up and down with a small frown of confusion, then shrug as he turned back to Jacob. She is kind of more hand, though. Yeah. And so began my conscious life. The thing is, it was totally true. I don't know why, and I in no way mean to impugn Jacob's manhood, but at age 7, I was 10 times the Han he'd ever been. And at that moment, with a great big thud of affirmation from my heart, I knew two things. First, there's no point in huffing around with a bad attitude and buns on either side of your head when you can drink heartily, pilot kick-ass spaceships, and get away with calling starry-eyed do-gooders kid. Second, for that simple act of recognition alone, my hand would follow Zach's loop anywhere, cheerfully killing any stormtrooper foolish enough to cross his path. My true nature and value had been seen, and with my masculinity thus avowed, I was free to worship my little heart out. Now, technically, Han Solo would not be considered a sidekick. Chewie's a sidekick, as are R2-D2 and C-3PO, and Han is a rogue archetype, a swashbuckler, a whole different breed. But in looking strictly at Star Wars' dramatic narrative as a hero's journey, a la Young, Campbell, or Vogler, one could make the case that Luke is the story's protagonist, and Han is one of the allies who helps him through his trials. In any case, that's an academic argument. I'm using the term sidekick very loosely here, to define those who devote themselves to the well-being of someone else, even when doing so is somewhat against their better and or normally self-serving judgment. And I'm so defining it for wholly personal reasons. I've long since moved on from Han, carefully sifting through an ever-expanding roster of fictional entities in search of the very best fits, and it is this adoration of sidekicks that has led me to my geekdom. Growing up, I read detective novels because of Sherlock Holmes' Watson and Hercule Poirot's Loyal Hastings, of whom I had quite the fictional crush. I watched science fiction because of Han and the original Battlestar Galactica's adventurous Starbuck, and read vampire genre fiction because of the reckless but nonetheless munificent devotion Anne Rice's vampire Lestat lavishes on every one of his acolytes, from Nikki to Louis to Armand. In my 20s, I discovered, devoured, and forged a career in comic books because, and only because, of Batman's devoted not-quite-son Robin. I still play pencil and D20 RPGs at least once a week so that I can be various tragic heroes protecting the sidekick-like devotion their doomed loves. And although some tanks will argue that they're leaders, I play computer games for the sheer joy of jumping in front of a friend's avatar to dutifully pull and pound at whatever mob they direct me toward on TS. I'm also enough of a geek not to want to stop and explain what tank, RPG, IRL, pull mob, or TS mean. Even novice geek vocabulary is as carefully guarded as a secret handshake. What sounds modish and eloquent in the context of online gaming is all too quickly demystified when linked back to the programming abbreviations and acronyms used by game developers and testers. Besides, you have to earn your geekdom comprehension. For me to just tell you would go against the dictates of male camaraderie. I learned that from the first clerk I ever approached in a comic book store. When I asked how to find comics that featured Robin, he frowned at me like I was some strange interloper and mumbled something about a wizard. It took me 2 more years to realize he'd been referring to Wizard, a flashy trade magazine devoted to comic books. The second guy I asked was a close friend, who's here tonight, and his perplexing answer, which Robin, only told me. You can't become a comic geek overnight. To be misunderstood by the mainstream is easy, but to become truly incomprehensible to all but yourself takes a great deal of practice. Who is here, and that's good. And she's a freelance writer living in San Francisco. And apart from her Neville Longbottom geekiness, which you're going to hear about in a second, she also finds video games very difficult to resist. She's an avid anime and manga collector. And her website, should I tell them your website?
Sure.
It's neville-sam.com, so write that down. All right. Please welcome Michelle.
In the whole big tradition of geekiness and geekdom, I'm very nervous up here right now.
Just pretend you're Neville.
Sorry, no.
Pretending you're Harry.
Yeah. Yeah, good point.
Okay. I'm just going to start from the beginning and see how far I can go before I end. Okay. Beyond character sheets. I pretend I'm a fictional character on the internet. In real life, I'm a Filipino-American woman on the brink of her 30s, 32 now, but who lives in Northern California. But I write a blog in the persona of a 19-year-old male who lives in the United Kingdom and teaches at a prominent school there. I guess I should also mention that he used to be classmates with Harry Potter. Yes, that Harry Potter. I'm a journal role player. I don't care about stats or quests or bringing my character to the next ability level. I care about storytelling and interactivity. I'm part of a world of freeform online role-playing. We call ourselves character bloggers. The internet is tailor-made for creative anonymity. Look at the countless numbers of so-called celebrity blogs and live journals and MySpace accounts that fill up every corner of the web. Are most of these real? Not by a long shot. Most of these famous people blogs are thought up by bored nobodies who want to experience the illicit thrill of pretending to be someone else without the baggage of not physically looking like the people they're portraying. People like me. Number two, rampant fan speculation. For many fans of the Boy Wizard, the Harry Potter books just aren't enough. A voracious fandom has sprouted around these soon-to-be seven novels. Many people write their own stories featuring the characters from the books, and most fanfiction writers and readers seem to be female. Maybe women are more willing to explore the what-ifs that fanfiction made possible. We're more open to playing with and stretching the characters, writing them into scenarios the original author wouldn't touch. And it seems we're more open to sharing our own works and supporting each other. The only problem with fanfiction is that it's static. Once you send the story into fanfiction.net or post it to a live journal community, it's done. The story has an end, and apart from other people speaking with the original author, the ideas and plots contained within the story have been locked away. But what if you don't want the story to end or be static? What if you want to immerse these characters into an ongoing, interactive, serial story while exploring ideas that won't ever show up in the original books? That's where online journal role-playing comes in. Search any popular journaling site, like LiveJournal or its code cousin Greatest Journal, and you'll find hundreds of accounts of people claiming to be Harry Potter, Ronald Weasley, Hermione Granger, and the rest of J.K. Rowling's dramatis personae. Exploring further, and you'll notice nearly all of these accounts are connected to journaling communities. These characters gain new life when unleashed upon the internet in the hands of capable players. Just like fanfiction writers, the vast majority of Harry Potter role players are female, and many of them must play male characters. Not every girl can play Hermione. Someone's got to be Harry, or Ron, or Snape, or Remus, or Neville. Number three, gaming in drag. I'm a heterosexual female in a healthy relationship. Right there, so. But I still feel a need to satisfy my curiosity about the opposite sex. I may have a boyfriend, but that doesn't mean I understand the way his mind works. Portraying a male character gives me the freedom to explore what it means to be a guy. It also gives me the freedom to experience how the world may treat a man. Once I log into my account, everyone treats me like a man. Whenever I interact with another user, we both stay in character, whether we're male, female, or inhuman, since some people can't play centaurs, house elves, giants, and other magical creatures in Harry Potter. As long as I believe my male character is speaking with another user's male character, even if both of the users behind the keyboards are female, then it's true. Although I haven't told my boyfriend I roleplay a male character. We'll see if we get home together. I'm going to get lost in the city and outside of city lights. I doubt it would bother him. He already knows I write fiction with male protagonists, and I consider journal or blog role-playing as an extension of writing fiction. The only reason I haven't told him is because he finds Harry Potter boring.
Charlie Anders.
If you want to scoot in and there's some
space you can sit on the floor here, you know. I don't mind if there's commotion while I talk. So, I'm a policy wonk. I don't know if anybody knows what a policy wonk is. We're like the bane of everybody's existence. We make what should be simple and clear-cut problems into like complex and intractable, you know, mazes of numbers and options and, you know, millions of studies and feasibilities. And there's actually a seat, a chair right there too. That wants to sit in an actual chair. And so, you know, my particular brand of wonk is that I'm a healthcare wonk, which means I'm obsessed about, like, why can't we insure everybody who doesn't have insurance? Why can't we improve, you know, outcomes for all the people with, like, chronic illnesses, you know, without spending up costs, all that kind of crap. And so my essay's about that, and about how I kind of came into my wonkhood at the same time as I came into my womanhood, and how I sort of associate the two things. So I'm just going to read a tiny, tiny snippet of it. I became a wonk about the same time that I became a woman. So the two things have always been kind of inseparable for me. Before I became a woman, I worked as a reporter, covering healthcare for a weekly business newspaper. In that job, I fell in love with the jargon and minutiae of health policy. Broken, messy, and dysfunctional, just like me, our nation's healthcare system held the promise that I would never run out of weird facts and details to learn about. I loved uncovering all the intricate structures that actually mattered to everyone, whether they knew it or not. This was the heyday of managed care, and there was just never-ending amounts of crap to sift through in the managed care system. I miss it so much. I mean, it's still around, but it's not as insane as it was 5 or 10 years ago. It was awesome. At the time, I was living in the Bible Belt and trying my best to be, if not a manly man, at least not a sprig of parsley. I was working at the super macho newspaper where, you know, not very many women ever got to be reporters. It was a business newspaper full of hard-charging guys chasing hard news. And one day my editor came over to my cubicle where I was poring over a huge stack of rich documents about, you know, medical loss ratios and stuff. And he bent over my shoulder and said, "Look, we don't want any of this what does it mean shit." Marlboro sent a condemnation at me and put one hand down to break the furious dragging and clicking of my mouse. At that point, a bomb went off in my head. Like the cartoon Mad Bomber icon my ancient Macintosh always displayed whenever I tried to save a document. So, skipping forward, I finally got another job where I was able to obsess to my heart's content about, you know, the reasons for drive-through mastectomies and drive-through brain surgeries and, you know, drive-through necrophilia and everything else, and, you know, that our healthcare system has created. And, you know, my new boss actually encouraged wonkiness. My coworkers got used to me hopping around the office, shouting with excitement about something I had discovered on the page 900 of the latest Federal Register. Every day was like Christmas. At that time, I started cross-dressing and fantasizing about being a beautiful, sophisticated woman who understood all about health outcomes and benchmarking. See, in the mainstream American culture, taking the long view, looking at the bigger picture, delving into the details is considered kind of womanly behavior when it comes to policy. A real man is not supposed to be overly concerned with too many facts or subtleties. If one is interested in analyzing the wider ramifications of that issue, you're either a woman or a girly man or some weird, you know, combination of. This is like the gender fuck rating tonight, actually. It's great. Small wonder that I came to associate white paper mania with femaleness. But, so, and then I talk about how I've become like an uber wonk and how I now know way too much about the pros and cons of like inflating a balloon inside your spine. But my ambition is not just to keep working as an interpreter of other people's wonkiness. One day, I want to make a serious, wonky contribution to the world. In my sweetest dreams, I use my wonkish superpowers to advance the causes of feminism and nobody's supremacy. Maybe I can help untangle the mess of childcare problems, inadequate health coverage, and faulty gender assumptions that keep so many people trapped in weird no-win situations. I have a feeling if anybody solves problems like those, you'll be a wonk. Thanks a lot. up, we've got the fantastic Quinn Norton, who is a freelance journalist and busy mom. Her baby's also under the table. She recently acquired a set of first edition AD&D books and an interesting group of people. Please welcome Quinn Norton.
My essay is about tabletop gaming. There's a lot in this book that's all very kind of science and people doing amazing things, but we seem to be veering a little bit more towards hobbies.
Hobbies are amazing.
Alright. So mine is entirely about, it's not entirely about tabletop, because the section I'm actually going to read from is about LARPing. Which I described recently as light tabletop, but more publicly embarrassing. Alright, I'm just going to dive right in. The things I learned in gaming turn out to apply beautifully to real life. Here's a helpful list. Expect fights in bars and taverns. Go on, check the door. It's unlocked more often than you'd think it would be. When all else fails and all hope is lost, it never hurts to choose to disbelieve. Sometimes in life, narrative trumps all the other rules. The dice favor style. When you're hopelessly lost, the right-hand rule will get you out. Orange County, 1995. Live-action role-playing LARPing of Vampire the Masquerade hit big. All the rules lawyering was gone because the White Wolf system that governed how Vampire was played focused on role-play above all else, and I could role-play like a motherfucker. I had one main character called Chaos. She was crazy, barely hanging on to enough reality to stay alive as a vampire. Crazy I could do. I took her on the road and played her in vampire games all over the United States. She was the bomb. She was the one and only character who was part of my identity. I liked many characters over the years, and I tried out ideals and ethics and behaviors with many of them, but Chaos was the one and only character who was actually a bit about me. Maybe that's because it was the first time I was in a safe enough place to ask questions about myself in-game. Chaos was a part of me that was crazy, delicate, and couldn't survive exposure to the rough world. When I played her, I asked, what happens when your disconnected, empathic, wondering self is all you have? What's it like wandering around the world totally defenseless? My answers were heartening. Everywhere I took her, other characters tried to protect her. Chaos confirmed to me that in many ways, people do value inner delicacy. One night, I was wandering around in San Juan Capistrano early in Chaos' career. I hadn't run into any other players, and I was getting a bit bored. I thought I heard fellow gamers' voices above me in a parking garage and decided to join them. Instead of the stairs, my trench coat wearing Malkavian took to the trees. I climbed up and over the second floor of the garage and threw myself quietly over the wall, coat flying behind me. I landed surprisingly silently. It turned out the voices came from two families of moviegoers, parents talking while young kids ran in bored orbits around them. I, in all my weirdness, appeared out of nowhere and walked quickly by them. The parents never noticed me, but the kids did. They looked at where I'd come from, and then at me. They crouched close to their parents and clutched one another. I looked at them, opened my eyes wide, and gave them a slightly snarled smile. They followed me with their eyes as I walked down the stairs. They never saw Quinn. They never even saw Quinn fighting Chaos. All they ever saw or knew was Chaos, mad vampire, coming from and going to nowhere. With a mysterious grin, Chaos had given line to the boring world their parents described, where everything stayed the same in the dark as it does in the light. I knew whatever make-believe they played the next, I was going to crop up. That moment is why I came. An after-lunch dinner in San Juan Capistrano in 1996, the GM raised a toast and spoke about my ability to roleplay. He said that I helped make the game more real for others. I was thrilled. It was strange after all this time to recognize the skill in something nobody really has a place for. Everyone nodded happily, and I noticed for the first time in my life that the girls weren't so rare. The GM ended, the next time, Quinn, could you say your character runs at the moving train rather than actually running at the moving train? We all laughed, but I said no. That's just how I play. It's hard to describe skill in gaming. It's about narrative, playing the character you've made. It's almost the opposite of acting, because you need to think of what the person would say in the moment rather than repeating and interpreting words someone else has written. But it's also about memorization, being able to recall the rules well enough to not interrupt the flow of the story. Starting with character generation, you may put them in play, you play accurately, but you also weave the narrative in with all the other characters. They never really play male characters. There are enough boys, so why do you know this? Part of my skill appeared to be putting up the tons of harassment in both my characters and me. At the time, I was able to handle abuse and sexual innuendo in huge doses. It was a requirement. It wasn't a total innocent, mind you. I slept with a lot of gamer boys. I mean, I could, couldn't I? Here they are in chronological order. Jason, Art, Troy, Billy, Shelby, Jeremy, Dan, Arjun, Edward, Shannon, Mike. I had a lot of sex. I played with swords, but I made a terrible princess. Being with the boys in fantasy life, mainly without girls, confused people, even the well-intentioned, I was generally asked, are you a slut or something? I always said I was something else. The biggest issue with me with being a slut is that you're still just one to either be saved or shunned. I wanted to be seen as a really good gamer, but I didn't want that to mean I had to give up sex or relationships. The boys certainly didn't think they had to. I was doing it for fun, and sex was fun. I tend to have sex with people I wanted to have sex with. Some of them were people I was in love with. Some of them just looked like they'd be fun. Everyone was confused. The boys by my sexuality and me by what a big deal people made of it. To this day, I'm still not clear on what the problem was. San Francisco, 2006. When I sat down to write this, I asked both men and women what they thought about gaming. I was told most women view gaming as an infection boys get. It's true, too. I was an invader in the secret life of boys. Worst of all, in the secret inner life of boys. Where there are badass heroes and the voices of God. I wanted it too. I wanted the secret life of bone dragons and talking swords. They told me I couldn't because I was a girl, and besides, I was crazy to want it. I spent years being beaten and wooed, and I had no idea why until years later. In gaming, all the boys wanted me because I was a gamer girl, but they also wanted me the hell out of their fantasy lives. Boys get better fantasy lives. Go steal them. Sometimes I'm back in 1996 in Florida, playing vampire in the middle of a dark park. I'm walking around in skiing mud, tail end of the tampon hanging out. I'm grinning. I explain to the horrified boys, it's tea. Linda's my dungeon master right now. She's taking me into the pit to write the slave. Just like we're asleep. So it's actually true. Next reader is Morgan. Is it Romine or Romine?
Romine.
Romine. See, I didn't have either one right. It's Morgan Romine who cracked the internet in half at a certain point when she helped form the Frag Dolls, who are an all-girl gamer group and totally kick ass. And her gaming name is Roulette. I'm just reading a chunk of your... She has a very long set of credentials here, so I'm just skip to the fact that she's currently a community manager for Ubisoft, a gaming company, and she interacts directly with their core video game audience and serves as a communication hub between the gaming communities and the dev teams. In her personal gaming life, she is currently playing games such as World of Warcraft, Ghost Recon Advanced Warfighter, Halo 2, awesome, Guitar Hero, and Oblivion. So please welcome Morgan.
Shadow
LARPing was designed so that the guild leader acquired enough influence to persuade another guild to swear fealty to her. She would then rule a nation, and her people would call her queen. In a way, it meant that a queen and her nation were strong enough to acquire yet another protectorate. The guild would control an empire, and its leader would become empress. The developers intended for empires to be extremely difficult to build and almost impossible to maintain, so naturally, emperor, or empress in my case, was the most coveted title for power-hungry players. After all those years of mental preparation, after reaching so many decisions by asking, if I were Princess Peach, what would I do? I wrote to myself and my fellow gamers to give it a shot. On a side note, Princess Peach would go get captured and be locked in the castle. That's not actually what I would do. But nonetheless, she was kind of the easiest princess to play to. I started following Shadowbane 1.5 years before the game was released to the public, and by that time, the online community forums were already a hotbed of political activity. It was obvious from the start that success was going to require copious amounts of charm, social savvy, in addition to extensive knowledge about the game world. Diving into the fray, I aimed to learn as much as possible about my future friends and enemies. My socializing rapidly branched from the forums into IRC and instant message conversations, and my maneuverings took place on multiple levels. Because the early stages of my guild recruitment were based on reputation, I crafted my guild by becoming a diligent student of the community soap opera. I studied forum posts to detect weaknesses and tension. I noted the names of those who had previously been with other guilds and those who were friends in real life. I collected email addresses and I have screen names and built bridges, all while creating my princess persona, Talvor Raven Song. I intended for my character's name to sound gender ambiguous. Decidedly kick-ass, yet still RPG cheesy for a fantasy because a woman leader walks a fine line when asking gamers to follow her. She gets benefits from being a female, but it's also possible to lose respect by being too girly. Luckily, though, I discovered that the same feminine charm that had worked so well in EverQuest easily carried over to Shadowbane. Many male egos found it easier and often more exciting to swear fealty to a woman, and some were enamored with the idea of flirting with a queen, though they were consequently prone to being more jealous of my attentions. I didn't flirt with all of them, but when I needed a particularly juicy piece of information, some favor done, or the trust of an important friend, I was shameless about how I used my implied promises and subtle suggestions to get my way. The cyber equivalent of brushing up against an arm, a light touch to emphasize a point, and a mischievous giggle were all my political weapons of choice, well honed from my years in chat room and EverQuest chatting. I even reached a point where I could tailor my flirting techniques to each specific target, although I tried not to use this power too maliciously. Part of this was good diplomacy, but it was also partly trouble in the making. In hindsight, I shouldn't have been surprised by the drama that started to creep into my guild life. Little did I know then that this was only the beginning of the drama that would become a constant in my guild leadership and princessing. By the time the game was launched, my guild, the Corvus, had grown to 50 active members, mostly guys whom I got along with smashingly. I would represent their interests, mediate their disputes, and favor them with girly attention. They would raise money for our city, crusade against my enemies, and favor me with their collective attention. My unique diplomatic methods won us friends in several large and powerful guilds, and where these geek factions did not get along with each other, my feminine charms could again be thanked for eventually making our neutrality possible. Ours was one of the first cities raised, and within a few weeks, a smaller guild planted its city near ours and swore fealty to the Corvus. Becoming the queen seemed almost too easy. Not long after the glow of this accomplishment faded, I realized that governing my guild had turned into a full-time job. Maintaining our place in a world that was becoming gradually more hostile was difficult enough without the guild's own growing pains. When the novelty of being ruled by a woman started to wear off and my guild members began expecting more of my attention, I had to adapt to my management techniques. I was able to hold everyone together by relying less on my female advantages. Instead, I cashed in on a backlog of respect points. I earned a new appreciation for the tough love approach when the drama frayed my nerves and made my hold on charm tenuous at best. By the time we had 200 role players displaying the Corvus guild crest, I had morphed from a flirtatious fantasy geek princess into a no-nonsense, high-efficiency queen. In May 2003, just over 2 months after the launch of the game, the Corvus became an empire, which was an astounding accomplishment by all accounts. This coronation ceremony, however, represented something different to me than what the one before it had. Earning the title of queen felt like the culmination of all my daydreams and girly desires to be loved for being special. Becoming empress guaranteed that Talvor Ravensong and the Corvus would forever be part of the game server's legend, but ultimately, it felt like a heavy responsibility. earning the game's highest honorific had required me to sustain an intense level of focus and involvement, as I found myself answering for the gaming experience of 200 other players. People can take their recreation very seriously. Playing at Princess went from fun and games to sweat and tears work.
Is the other co-editor of the book, Annalee Newitz, and in case you missed her intro because you got here late, she wrote Pretend We're Dead, she's the editor of Other Magazine, and she writes the Textploitation column and is a contributing editor with Wired Magazine. Please welcome Annalee Newitz.
So I'm just going to read a short little chunks from my essay, which is called When Diana Prince Takes Off Her Glasses. Diana Prince is the secret identity of Wonder Woman.
Duh.
So it starts when I'm a very young child. On the suburban lawn outside our condo, I imitate the way Diana Prince becomes Wonder Woman every week on television. I pretend to pull my hair out of a tight bun, take off my imaginary glasses, and spin around until I explode like a star going nova. When the light withdraws, I'm wearing her lasso of truth and her bulletproof bracelets. The glasses have disappeared. For the rest of my life, I find myself thinking occasionally about that transformation. In my 30s, I buy the DVD box sets of the Wonder Woman TV shows to see if it holds up over time. Unfortunately, the plots are silly, and Wonder Woman's heroism is very self-effacing. Oh, Steve, it's just little old me lifting up this tank. Still, the moment when Wonder Woman takes off her glasses is burned into the retinas of my unconscious. She's a geek until she takes them off, but afterward, she's a fantasy. Not just because of her super strength and invisible plane, but because she's smart, commanding, and sexually appealing at the same time. As anyone familiar with mainstream U.S. culture knows, such a woman is not supposed to exist. My first lasso of truth is a K Pro 4 with two floppy drives and a tiny green CRT screen. It has a modem, which my friend John explains is for logging into a thing called a BBS, or a computer bulletin board system. He knows a good one called WizNet, where up to a dozen people can chat at the same time. Every night, I log into WizNet and talk until all hours of the morning with people whose bodies are lines of glowing text. I pick a gender-neutral handle, Shockwave Writer. Everybody assumes I'm male, and I don't bother to correct them. I write my first story about high-tech outlaws in high school. It's about my best friends who recently cracked a piece of software. Cracking, in the lead speak of the day, means breaking the copy protection scheme that prevents people from making free copies of the program. I sit with them while they go over dot matrix printouts and get them to teach me about assembly language and how to turn Apple's graphics program MathPaint into something that anybody can download for free. Later, they teach me about phreaking, a way of hacking the phone system so you can make free long-distance phone calls. I sit at my K-Pro for days, composing a tale about geeks who are romantic outlaws, liberating software for the benefit of humanity. My English teacher isn't too crazy about the story, but I gain a reputation among the computer nerds as a strange and unexpected ally. One of the freakers uses a version of my name as a password to his BBS, and I am honored. And now I'm just going to read you a short piece from when I grew up and became a science journalist. And this is a little bit about what happens to you psychologically when you kind of expect that people will underestimate you because of, you're a woman, and so sometimes you're an asshole. It's 1999, and I'm at a press conference for a company whose business model is to sell services to companies using Linux. I actually have no idea where this company is now. It probably fell off the NASDAQ with all the rest of the nice Linux companies from that era. I'm talking with another tech journalist, a guy who favors the same cheap engineer's glasses I do, and he's congratulating me on an article I've just published in the San Francisco Chronicle. It's about a group of Linux enthusiasts who spend most of their weekends at trade shows doing install fests. They'll help anyone install and start running Linux on any computer. It's their way of challenging the Microsoft Windows hegemony one box at a time. A primary source of my story is the elusive head of a semi-underground group called the Linux Cabal. So how did you manage to get him to talk to you? The journalist asks, narrowing his eyes. He won't ever talk to me. Okay, so maybe I'm paranoid. Maybe I'm sensitive. But suddenly I realize that I'm the only woman in the room, except for a few marketing droids who look like they were paid mostly to look good in heels and lipstick. And I hear a barb in this guy's query, so I tell him exactly what I think he's implying. I flirted with him. I say, yeah, it's lucky I'm a girl, because geeks always want to talk to me. And then I stalk away. To the journalist's credit, he looks confused and a little shaken. Why didn't I just tell him the truth? I could have explained that I spent a whole weekend at the trade show, sitting at the Install Fest table and getting retired and getting to know everybody who came. I watched install after install, saw kids and retirees get excited at the sight of a command line. I learned the pros and cons of different Linux distributions, and I even talked to the gadfly trying to interest people in FreeBSD. I should say OpenBSD, I mean, like, the people in the front row would yell at me. I made Cthulhu jokes, and I admitted that Data is my favorite character on Star Trek The Next Generation. I could have said that if you actually go out and pound the pavement and take the time to get to know people, they'll talk to you. I could have explained to him, this is my philosophy of good journalism, but I didn't. A few months later, I do an experiment. I decide to write an entire article about biotech using only female sources. I call scientist after scientist, getting amazing information about how to compare mouse and human genomes with small number-crunching programs and constantly growing databases of genetic information. Each source refers me to several other top-notch women in the cutting-edge field of computational biology. One builds her own data-matching computer clusters. Another wrote the software that allows people to browse fruit fly genomes. It's one of the coolest articles I've ever written, and every name in it is female.
Started conversation that didn't used to exist.
So.
When did it choose to be on as someone who
My particular interest is women who are in science, and a lot of women who are currently in science often choose to be anonymous, especially if they're in heavily male-dominated fields, because that could be a bit risky. Science can be a very conservative culture, and identifying themselves, you know, might put themselves at risk. Some people do feel more secure where they're at, and so then they do blog under their own names. Yeah,
the culture of chemistry blog is a woman's really awesome. So, I think you had your hand up.
For anyone who has a good story, have you ever had a moment where you had the choice of educating somebody about sexism that they were just playing or letting it slide, and how did you deal with it?
Wow.
I was at a comic convention in Texas and had been lured there under, you know, the idea of, like, wow, I'll see Texas and that'll be cool. And it turned out there was this whole day set up about women in comics. And I was the only one at a particular convention. And so I sort of said to the guy, well, why would we do this? Why not just stick me up on a panel and I'll talk? And he goes, no. I got this guy who writes Scooby-Doo, and we're going to put the two of you together in a room, and you're going to do, like, the female and male point of view. We're going to have this argument about it. And so I felt myself getting really angry, and normally when I'm at a convention, I'm sort of in the smile and nod, you know, just go with it. And I just decided, I'm in Texas. What the fuck am I going to be in Texas again? Who cares? And I said, you know, no, that's actually really insulting, and I appreciate you trying to bring attention to the work that women do, but singling me out as female when there's no other context for it. Like, there's, why not just have a Batman panel and I'll talk on that, or have the work of Devin Grayson panel? Why does it have to be a female panel? And he was really insistent, and he had his programs printed out. So that was just it. We were following the program. So the Scooby-Doo guy and I got up, and I convinced him to take the female point of view. The convention guy walked behind us a few times and sort of looked confused, but the audience was totally into it. It was sort of a constructive reworking of what they were expecting that hopefully left an impression on the minds of young Texans.
So you had your hand up before.
I did have a point, and I temporarily forgot it. Which was... So Joss Whedon wrote Buffy, which is, you know, this fabulous thing about a boy and a girl in a high school, and then she kills him by ripping throats out. And then he wrote Firefly and Serenity, which is, seems to have, like, a much higher percentage of women in the fandom than a lot of other kind of sci-fi Western. Sci-fi and Western, typically very male-dominated, put them together, large female fan contingent. Doesn't necessarily follow. And now he's writing Wonder Woman. What sort of touch do you think he has that seems to make him, for a bat-holding geek guy, seems to have kind of magic?
For me, what I see in that is that these characters in these situations are very aspirational. And usually the female characters are something you want to aspire to, but Joss is our, you know, it's just that simple. I really would like to be some of those people, you know, as versus some of the women.
Yeah, Edwards are me.
What Quinn is saying, and also, I mean, I think that for a lot of female geeks, we grow up watching geeky pop culture, and it's all full of male characters who you want to be, and, you know, of course you can identify with men, just as men can identify with women, but after you've had to do it 100% of the time your whole life, it gets a little old, and so it's nice to have heroic female characters, because you're like, hey, that could be me. So,
what were you going to say? Something?
I would just say that, I mean, this stuff is good, you know? Really, really good. Whereas I've seen some concerns in my life, but the genre generally doesn't interest me. But, I mean, Joss, but his stuff is really winning. And, I mean, to speak to Firefly specifically, I love the fact that his mean, I would say she's a sidekick because she probably would kick his ass in any situation. But like she's the most kick ass in my opinion. And now, of course, I'm like, what her name is.
Zoe.
And then, of course, it's Beth at the top of my list. She's really hot. So.
And Jean.
Hi, well, I was a hardware designer. You can imagine how many males were, how many females were there. Me and 100 guys. I still, to this day, actually, am a hardware junkie. I find components and boxes very erotic. But it's a problem, actually, that I am invisibilized by a lot of women, too, because people are mostly coming from the software side. It's too far over there. So I would be great to get a few more women in the hardware. So hardware is really cool.
We're here.
After I got replaced by a computer, I started doing journalism, and I would go to a lot of computer shows, and I discovered if I wanted to get an answer to something, that talking to the women there, because they were the best, they had to be the best to be there, especially somebody in a significant position. So if I wanted to know an answer to a question, the women. Because I got a lot of bullshit from guys, a lot of people just tripping on guy bonding and how they got their job, but the women were the best. But things like then I got into covering crypto, and there was a period there where there were lots of women, and then all the homeland security money had just got swept out. So it's a new economics.
Well, crypto clearly
means
something other than Superman's.
Why did she not name it Bob Mace?
He was already named. Was the computer that replaced you male or female?
Well, numerous computers replaced me, actually.
Everybody has all.
And those are not the only two choices that I made.
I grew up on Peanuts. You're familiar with that? I hope. Which of the female Peanuts characters do you all admire, if any?
They all suck. I'm sorry, come on.
Why is that?
Actually, that's not true. I like the little fluffy.
I like the
ones that are
Snoopy.
I was very Snoopy identified.
Marcy's
sweet.
She's
bad.
Yeah.
Well,
it's all about Snoopy.
Hey, I'm wondering about continuity in journal-based roleplay or journal-based fan fiction.
Right.
If there are multiple people who are journaling as the same character, how do they interact with each other? But how do they decide which particular people to interact with and how to manage continuity of their story?
For in my experience, it's always been one person per character, or people can pick up multiple characters and they would usually have like a different account they would log into as Harry or Ron or whoever. And I think as continuity-wise, it's simpler when you have people agreeing beforehand what characters would play, how the storylines would develop, and also
is it by community?
Yeah, it's by community basically. And what's interesting to me is the way that sometimes people leave in the digital communities, digital online role-playing communities, and sometimes they would have, and people would replace these other players with try to continue on with the character, but sometimes it wouldn't be the same. Because basically you have different people playing the same character, and sometimes if the continuity isn't there. So it's basically up to the people actually, so yeah.
So do you have these parallel narratives where there's one community developing a particular story in one way and another?
Right,
all running in parallel.
Right, yes. That, Right now, I could count up like 50 communities that are taking over what happened at the end of the Half-Blood Prince and before what will happen in the last book. Probably more.
Do you have like crossovers, like when Harry met Harry?
there's a community on LiveJournal called The Nexus, and that is where incarnations of the same characters can meet and interact, but
the Harry who folded himself.
Do you ever have a kind of crisis of interest? It's very comic book. There was a DC comic series called Crisis in Infinite Spaces.
The
DC decided they were going to clear up all the continuity errors. Deciding there were 9 Earths or something, and 12.
Like, that was 2. That was the second one. Now we went to 0 hour and
yeah,
back to 1.
And everything just exploded. And then it came back. And then they fucked up the continuity game. And then they kept doing franchise stuff. But do you have anything like that? Like, kind of these great kind of everything returns back to zero kind of things, or
that usually happens when too many people leave the game at the same time, so the characters and storyline can't go on. So a lot, so the people who are left say, just plug it, just let's start over.
It's like hard reboots, right? Any other questions? One more question.
Which representations of female leads in the media, if any, do you like? Which fictional characters? Getting
annoyed
about being a female
geek.
Willow.
Yeah. Female vampire, lesbian Willow, or
normal? Both.
Daria
kind of
is
a geek.
Daria?
Sure.
Yeah.
I like
Daria.
Maybe fostering contact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dad?
I really liked Princess Leia because she was a princess and she ran around shooting people. And, you know, it was like, she was like the first princess that was allowed to run around shooting people, so I thought that was good.
Back to Firefly. You got me a kick. I would start on the Battlestar Galactica, but Starbuck doesn't really count as a geek, I would say, but I worship her anyway.
I totally worship Starbuck.
Duala's
great. These are all Battlestar Galactica characters. I really like Trinity because she actually used a map, which is great. And also she can shoot guns, she can hack. You know, the whole weird thing at the end with Neo is kind of sad, but just ignore that. The last part of the last movie. Yeah.
Wait, she was not talking about Firefly.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Battlestar Galactica does that to your brain.
I know.
She's a mechanics geek. You never see a female mechanic, like, ever.
True. Yeah.
And the fact that she talks about how she's got, like, just this kind of sense, like, it's a female intuition for the meat machines is awesome. She's a hardware geek.
Wasn't there Bonnie from Knight Rider, though?
What?
Bonnie from Knight Rider? Yeah. You know, the one that took care of Kit?
Wow.
What about Laura Croft from Tomb Raider?
Actually, the new companion for Doctor Who is going to be a geek. She's
really?
Going to be a medical doctor.
Oh, okay.
A med student.
Okay.
Sorry, I meant spoilers. So,
now you're all in the circle. So, we'll be signing the book, and we'll be, you know, whatever else you want us to do in your book to personalize it. Anyway, thanks a lot. Thanks for coming.